Chapter 16. Kylar sat on the bed in the darkness, looking at Aline's sleeping form. She was the kind of girl who just couldn't stay up late, no matter how hard she tried. The sight of her filled him with such tenderness and wretchedness, he could hardly bear it. Since she'd promised not to ask him to sell retribution, she'd been true to her word. No surprise there. But she hadn't even hinted. He loved her. He wasn't good enough for her. He'd always believed that you became like those you spent your time with. Maybe that was part of it. He loved all the things about her that he wasn't. Openness, purity, compassion. She was smiles and sunshine. And he belonged to the night. He wanted to be a good man, ached for it. But maybe some people were just born better than others. After that first night, he'd sworn to himself that he wouldn't kill again. He would go out and train, but he wouldn't kill. So he trained for nothing and honed his abilities he'd sworn not to use. Training was a pale imitation of battle, but he would be satisfied with it. His resolution held for 6 days. Then he was down at the docks and found a pirate savagely beating a cabin boy. Kylar had only intended to separate them, but the pirate's eyes demanded death. Retribution delivered it. On the seventh night, he'd been practicing simply hiding outside a midtown tavern, trying to avoid places that were likely to bring him across pimps or thieves or rapists or murderers. A man had passed by who ran a circle of child pickpockets, a tyrant who kept the children in line through sheer brutality. Retribution found the man's heart before Kylar could stop himself. On the eighth night, he'd been in the nobles' district, hoping to find less violence there, when he heard a nobleman beating his mistress. The night angel came in invisibly and broke both the man's arms. Kylar held Retribution in his lap, looking at Aline. Every day he promised himself he wouldn't kill. Not ever again. And he hadn't killed for 6 nights. But part of him knew that was because he'd been lucky. The worst part of it was that he didn't feel guilty for the murders. He felt awful every time he'd killed for Durzo. These kills did nothing. He felt guilty only for lying. Maybe he was becoming a huge gibbet. Maybe he needed killing now. Maybe he was becoming a monster. Each day, he worked with Aunt Mia. Durzo had rarely praised Kylar, so he'd never realized how much he had learned from the old wet boy. But as Kylar spent hours with Aunt Mia, cataloging her herbs, repackaging some of them so they would keep longer, throwing out those that had lost their potency, labeling the rest with dates and notes on their origins, he began to see how much he did know. He was nowhere near Durzo's level of proficiency, but the man had had a few centuries on him. He had to be careful, though. Aunt Mia used many herbs medicinally that he had used for poison. She had once set aside the roots of a silverleaf, saying they were too dangerous and that she could only use the leaves. Without thinking, he'd drawn up a chart of the lethal doses of the plant's leaves, roots, and seeds by their various preparations, whether in a tincture, a powder, a paste, or a tea, cross-referenced by body weight, sex, and age of the... He almost wrote of the deader, and only changed it to patient at the last second. When he looked up, Aunt Mia was staring at him.
"I've never seen such a detailed chart," she said. "This is very impressive, Kylar."
He tried to be more careful after that, but they consistently ran into the same problems. Over his career, Durzo had experimented thousands of times with all kinds of herbs. When he'd had a deader that he could kill without a deadline, he'd tried 5 or 6 different herbs. Kylar was beginning to appreciate that Durzo had probably known more about herbs than anyone alive, though he had usually been hired to kill healthy people, so sometimes what Kylar knew was useless. One day, a man came to Aunt Mia's shop desperate for help. His master was dying, and four other physickers had been unable to help him. Aunt Mia sometimes did more than midwifing, so the servant had come to her as a last resort. But Aunt Mia had been gone. Kylar had felt too awkward to go to the sick man's house, but after quizzing the servant, he'd made a potion. He heard later that the man recovered. It was strangely warming. He'd saved a life. Just like that. Still, he felt guilty for living on Aunt Mia's charity. He'd spent several weeks putting her shop in order, because despite her gift for working with people, her organization skills were abominable. But he hadn't done anything valuable for her. He wasn't making her any money. Aline had gotten a job as a maid, but the pay was barely enough to cover their food. Brayan was getting more and more surly, muttering about freeloaders. And Kylar couldn't blame him. Kylar brushed his fingertips over retribution. Every time he strapped the blade on, he acted as judge and executioner. The blade had become the emblem of his oath-breaking. Not tonight. Kylar put it back in its box and, gathering his talent, leapt out the window. He crossed the roofs to find Goldenhair's house and put everything else out of his mind. He had to worry all day long. He wasn't going to ruin his nights, too. The whole family was there, asleep in their little one-room shack. Kylar turned to go, but something stopped him. The girl and her father were asleep. The mother's lips were moving. At first, Kylar thought she was dreaming, but then her eyes opened, and she got out of bed. She didn't light any candles. She briefly looked out the narrow window where Kylar stood, invisible. She looked afraid, so much so that he double-checked his invisibility. But her eyes weren't fixed on him. He looked behind himself, but there was nobody in the street. Goldenhair's mother shivered and knelt by the bed.
Praying! Son of a bitch!
Kylar was at once embarrassed and angry to witness something so personal. He wasn't sure why. He cursed silently and turned to go. Three armed men were coming down the street. Kylar recognized two of them as the guys who'd chased Goldenhair the other night.
"She's a witch, I'm telling you,"
one of the thugs said to the man Kylar didn't recognize.
"It's true, Shinga, I swear,"
the other said.
"You're joking." Carnarvon's Shinga himself was checking out some thug's story about a witch?
A witch? As if a witch would have tripped the men rather than killing them. Kylar heard something and looked back inside. The woman had woken her husband and both were praying now. It was odd, because from their bed there was no way they could have seen the Sakage thugs. Maybe the woman had some talent. Praying for protection. Kylar sneered, and the small, mean part of him wanted to leave, let their god solve his own problems. Kylar got as far as turning his back, but he couldn't do it.
"Garrosh,"
one of the thugs whispered to the Shinga.
"What do we do?"
The Shinga slapped the man.
"Sorry, sorry,"
the man whined.
"I mean, Shinga Sniggle, what do we do?"
"We kill them."
Good gods. It was stunning. The Sakage here was such a bad parody of a Sakage that Kylar wanted to laugh. Except it wasn't funny. The Shinga slapped men to get their respect? In Cenaria, when Pon Drayden had looked at men with less than full approval, they wilted. And he hadn't even been the real Shinga. Kylar almost left from sheer disgust, the ineptitude. Still, one didn't need much to kill. A wet boy knew that. Oh, it made a lovely quandary, didn't it? Here he was, maybe one of the most skilled killers in the world. He could kill all three men before they could make a sound, and yet He couldn't even hurt them. In front of him were the dregs of the underworld, and they would kill, while he couldn't. Lovely. They were only 20 paces away.
What if she uses witchery again, Shinga?
Of course, they didn't bother to formulate their plan before they got to the target. That would be a bit professional. Baruch Sniggle snorted, approaching the door.
I ain't afraid of that shit.
As Kylar saw the man's eyes, his hand went to his back, but retribution was gone. His momentary surprise was enough to break him free of the killing impulse. He'd sworn. Damn him, he'd sworn. There had to be another way. Tonight, there would be another way. So Kylar materialized in front of the Shinga. Or rather, parts of him did. He let some light shine through the kakari that covered him, so that he appeared with a smoky translucence. The curve of an oily, iridescent black bicep shimmered in and out of visibility. Then the curve of broad shoulders, the V of his torso, the lines of his chest muscles, all of them exaggerated, so they seemed larger than they were. They faded in and out of sight, like a ghost. Baruch Sniggle froze, and then Kylar topped it with his master stroke. The kakari became solid over his eyes, making them gleam like metallic black jewels in midair. The rest of his face appeared, covered in a mask of black, shimmering metal molded to his skin. It was menacing. It was more than menacing. It was the very face of judgment, of retribution made flesh. And at what Kylar saw within the Shinga's eyes, hatred, envy, greed, murder, betrayal, the mask became fierce. Kylar had to dig his fingernails into his palms to keep from ending him. The Shinga dropped his cudgel. Kylar wasn't surprised. He knew what the man was seeing because he'd practiced it in the mirror.
This family, Kylar said in a voice as silky, soft as a stalking cat, is under my protection.
He brought his left hand up and flexed it.
With a hiss, the kakari slid out into a long, smoking punch dagger. Low blue fire sprang up in his eyes. It was totally gratuitous. It spoiled his night vision, not to mention feeling unpleasant, but the effect was worth it. The Shinga looked petrified, his mouth slack, and Kylar saw a stain spreading on the man's trousers and a puddle collecting around his feet.
Run, Kylar said, showing a glimpse of blue fire in his mouth.
I'm not going to taste anything for a week.
The thugs broke and ran, dropping their weapons. But Kylar felt no satisfaction. Just when he thought he couldn't paint himself any further into a corner, he'd done so brilliantly. What had Durzo Blint told him more than a decade ago?
A threat's a promise, boy.
On the street, you can lie about everything except your threats. An empty threat is surrender.
Feeling sick, Kylar looked into the house. The woman and her husband were still kneeling by their bed, holding hands. They hadn't seen or heard anything. As Kylar looked in, though, the woman squeezed her husband's hand.
We're going to be all right, she finally said aloud. I can tell. I feel better now.
I'm glad one of us does.
Not that long ago, you in this room were wives, mothers, a potter, a brewer, a seamstress, a ship captain, a glassblower, an importer, a money changer, Jarl said. This was Jarl's 6th time preaching, and it hadn't gotten easier. As he looked around at the rent girls and bashers of the Craven Dragon gathered before their shift, he saw awkwardness. They were whores now, and not by choice. Most didn't like to acknowledge that they had ever been anything else. It was too hard.
"Not that long ago," Jarl said, "I was a bender."
That lifted eyebrows.
Though Jarl bet they already knew he'd been a rent boy. He'd chosen the slur on purpose to show it had no power over him. Even among whores, rent boys were second class. They might be adored by the girls, but the clientele treated male prostitutes like dirt. A whore, though a whore, was still a woman, but a bender was something less than a man. That the new Shinga used to be one wasn't the kind of thing one would expect him to admit, much less announce.
"Not that long ago,
the Sakage was primarily smuggling riot weed and tobacco and whiskey," he said. Together, Jarl and Mama Kay had set up a lot of new brothels since the invasion. Most of them barely broke even, but that wasn't the point. They'd done it to protect as many women and men as they could. The Craven Dragon, however, was one of the lucrative ones because it catered to the exotic. There was a girl named Daedra who could have been Aline Cromwell's twin, without the scars. Virginal was her gig. Her sweet mate, Caldrosa Wynne, played a Sethi pirate. There were silk-clad Ladeshians and heavily cold Modainis and bell-wearing Imuri dancing girls.
"Now," Jarl said and paused.
"Your whores. I'm the Shinga, and the Sakage still smuggles the same damned things. Like nothing's changed. But I'll tell you something. I've changed. I got out. I'm different. I took my second chance and did something with it, and you can too." It was the only part of the sermon Jarl thought might be a lie. He'd asked Mama Kay about it.
"Why don't people argue about whether the earth is flat?" she asked.
Jarl shrugged. "It's general knowledge."
"Exactly," she said. "The things that evoke passion are the things we can't know for certain."
"Ah."
"Like the gods," Jarl said. "It doesn't matter whether you're sure everything you say is true. It matters that you passionately want to believe they're true, because then you'll be compelling. And in the end, what matters is not whether the girls believe your arguments. What matters is that they believe in you."
It was the kind of thing the old Mama Kay would have said. Jarl was vaguely disappointed. She had seemed different after the coup, after Kylar had poisoned her and given her the antidote. Perhaps the pressure of looking in the face of unrelenting evil was destroying her hope, but her pragmatism had the ring of truth. So Jarl preached on. He hadn't banged since he'd become Shinga. He hadn't slept with a man since he left Stefan's house the night of the invasion. But he hadn't slept with a woman either. He'd survived all his life by doing what he had to, always building his web of friends and influence, always looking to the future when he wouldn't have to whore. The future had arrived so suddenly, he didn't know what to do with it. Freedom lay useless in his hands. He didn't know how to feel. It reminded him of Harani iron bulls. He'd never seen one, of course, but it was said they captured the young calves and bound them to a stake with thick chains. By the time the iron bulls were full grown, more than 15 feet high at their mighty shoulders, they could snap the chains. But they didn't. Their handlers staked them out with thin rope. The iron bulls were so sure they couldn't get free, they never tried. Jarl had been chained to sex and pleasing his clientele for so long that now he felt sexless. He'd never had a choice before. Most of his clients were men, but there had been women, too, from the entire range of levels of attractiveness. Now that he had a choice, he couldn't make it. He couldn't have said with any certainty whether he would have preferred men or women if the life of a rent boy hadn't been forced on him. The girls at the brothels treated him differently now, They looked at him differently. They flirted. It was terrifying. Flirtation carried demands. There were appropriate and inappropriate responses to learn, and he didn't know the rules of sex outside a brothel. His regulars had always spoken of it as being unsatisfying, but then their experiences couldn't exactly be representative, or everyone would be regulars at a brothel. Wouldn't they? He was losing his focus. He couldn't think about this now. Hope had to be sold as a whole package. Of all the women in the Warrens, Jarl said, you're the luckiest. You were lucky enough to become whores here. He shook his head. Lucky enough to become whores. 6 months ago, most of you would have crossed the street rather than pass a whore. Now you are whores, and I'm the Shinga, and the Sakage is still doing the same damn things. King Orsul thinks you're finished. He plans to let the winter kill off most everyone in the Warrens. He figures that by the time the food riots get going, everyone will be so weak his soldiers will have no trouble with us. He figures that the Sakage is too passive and too greedy to stop him. He plans to split us apart by offering us scraps off his table to destroy each other. The funny thing is, Jarl said, he's right. We've learned that in the spring he's bringing down another army and a few thousand colonists, all of them men. He plans to kill everyone in the Warrens except you. Again, you'll be the lucky ones. You'll be married off to whichever Caladoran buys you. Now maybe the Caladorans will change and they'll stop with the beatings and the bedroom humiliations once you're their wives. Or Sul expects that you are such cowards, you'll hold on to that diseased hope. He expects that sick hope to paralyze you until it's too late, until your men are dead, your friends are scattered, and the Sakage's strength is broken. In a year you'll start bearing sons for your new Caladoran husbands, and have the joy of watching them turn into monsters who treat their wives as their fathers treat you. It'll be normal. You'll bear daughters who will think it's normal to be kicked and spit on and forced to... Well, you know all the things they'll be forced to do. Your daughters won't resist. They'll look to your cowardice and believe that such is a woman's lot. It'll be normal. That's what the king expects will happen, and he's been right about everything so far. Jarl had them now. He could see the horror in their eyes. Most rent girls thought only of today. They weren't stupid. They knew they couldn't work the sheets forever. But because they didn't see any good options for the future, they decided not to think about the future at all. It was too crushing. These women were in survival mode. Raising the specter of bearing their own daughters into the same life forced them to think beyond themselves. Beyond today. And Jarl hadn't been lying. These women would be the best off. If he could sell the women who had the most to lose, half the battle would be won. Things have changed in the last few months for each of us. For each of you and for me. Now I say it's time for things to change for all of us together. I say it's time for the Sakage to change. We've been at war and we've been losing. Do you know why? Because we haven't been fighting. The Caladorans want us to quietly die. Fuck 'em. We'll fight in ways they've never seen. The Caladorans are going to starve us? Fuck 'em. If we can smuggle riot weed, we can smuggle grain. They want to kill your men, we'll hide them. They want to conduct raids, we'll know where they're going before they do. They want to gamble, we'll cheat. They want to drink, we'll piss in their beer. What can we do? One of the girls asked. It was a planted question. He smiled. Right now? I want you to dream. I want you to think.
Not about going back to what we had before Kalidor came. I want you to dream of something better. I want you to dream of a day when being born in the Warrens doesn't guarantee dying in the Warrens. I want you to dream of getting a second chance, and what could happen for this city and this country if everyone got a second chance. Dream of raising your children in a city where they don't have to be afraid all the time. A city without corrupt judges or Sakage extortion. A city with a dozen bridges over the Plith and not a guard on one of them. A city where things are different. Because of us. I know you're scared right now. Your shift starts in a few minutes, and you have to go face those fuckers again, I know. It's fine to be frightened, but I'm telling you, be brave. Inside. The time is coming when you will be needed. If the nobles want to win this war and take this country back, they're going to need us, and our help is going to come at a price. Our price is a city that's different, and you and I get to decide how. You and I have that power. So for now, we can go on with things as usual. Or we can dream. And get ready. Out of everyone in the Warrens, you ladies have the most to lose. He walked over to the pirate girl, Keldrosa Wynne, and touched her cheek beneath one blackened eye. But tell me, is this what you gave up your husband for? A crown for a black eye? One more when they hurt you so bad you can't work the next day? Is this what you deserve? Tears leaked from Caldrosa's eyes. I say, hell no. You came here because it was the best you could do. You get a crown for a black eye because it's the best Mama Kay could negotiate. As your Shinga, I'm here to tell you that the best isn't good enough. We've been thinking too small. We've been trying to survive, and I, for one, am sick of surviving. The next time I hear a scream of pain, I want it to come from a Kalidoran throat. Hell yes, one of the girls whispered. He could see passion burning in their eyes now. Gods, they looked fierce. Jarl raised a hand. For now, just watch. Just wait. Be ready. Be brave. Because when our chance to roll the bones comes, we're gonna cheat. And we're gonna roll 3 sixes.
Honey, Eline said, shaking Kylar gently. Honey, get up.
Ass, he said.
What?
Ass!
Eline laughed.
You do look like someone sat on you, she said, hugging him.
She sniffed and grimaced.
And you stink.
Ass,
he said, wounded.
Honey, we've got to go shopping today, remember?
He grabbed a pillow and pulled it over his head. Eline leaned over to grab the pillow, but Kylar wouldn't let go of it. So she sang the good morning song. It consisted of the words good and morning, repeated 37 times. It was one of Kylar's favorites. Good morning, good morning, good morning, good morning.
Ass, assing, ass, assing, ass, assing,
Kylar harmonized into the pillow. She pulled on the pillow, and Kylar grabbed her and flipped her onto the bed next to him. He was so strong and so quick there was no resisting. He pulled the pillow away, rolled on top of her, and kissed her.
Uh-uh,
she said.
Oh, his lips felt good.
What?
He asked 30 seconds later.
Morning mouth,
she said, grimacing. It was a lie, of course. With the way his lips felt, she wouldn't have cared if he did have bad breath. But he didn't. His breath never smelled. Not just never smelled bad, he could chew mint leaves or moldy cheese, and his breath wouldn't smell at all. It was the same with the rest of his body. Put perfume on him, and it just disappeared.
probably something to do with the Kakari, he'd guessed.
So now he smiled his mock predatory smile. I'll show you morning mouth, he said.
He pushed through her flailing hands and kissed her cheek, and then lower on her neck. And then he was pulling down the neckline of her dressing gown, and her hands weren't flailing any more, and his lips.
Shopping!
She rolled out of his arms. He let her go. Kylar flopped back on the bed, and she pretended to straighten her dress while she admired the muscles of his bare torso. Aunt Mia had taken Uli out for the day. The house was empty. Kylar was so cute when his hair was squashed from sleep, and he was gorgeous, and his lips were the most amazing things in the world. Not to mention his hands. She wanted to feel his skin against hers. She wanted to put her hands on his chest, and vice versa. Sometimes, in the morning, they cuddled while he was barely conscious, and it had become her favorite time of day. Once or twice, her shift had ridden up during the night, and she had found herself spooned against him, skin to skin. Well, maybe her shift didn't ride up all by itself, and she wouldn't have dared it if she didn't know he'd been out for hours the night before and wouldn't possibly wake up. It made her warm just thinking about it. Why not? Part of her asked. So there were the religious reasons. Can an ox and a wolf be yoked together? She didn't even know if Kylar believed in the god. He always got uncomfortable when she talked about it. Her foster mother had told her to make her decisions before she got her heart involved. But that was water under the bridge and down the river and around the bend. Uli needed her. Kylar needed her. And she had never been needed like that before. Kylar made her feel beautiful and good. He made her feel like a lady. He made her feel like a princess. He loved her. He practically was her husband. They said they were married. They lived together, slept in the same bed, acted as father and mother to Uli. Probably the only reason she hadn't already made love with Kylar was that by the time he actually touched her most nights, she was so tired she could barely move. If he had tried in the morning what he did at night, she'd have surrendered her maidenhead in about 5 seconds. She could almost feel his breath in her ear. She imagined doing some of the things Aunt Mia had talked about so blithely, things that had set her face burning, but sounded ever so wonderful. She was feeling so brazen that she even knew which one she'd try first. Didn't the scriptures say, "Let your yes be yes and your no be no"? She'd said she was Kylar's wife. He'd said he was her husband. She'd take him past the ringery Aunt Mia had told her about, and they could formalize things in the Wadrinner way later. Afterward. Kylar sat up in bed and she leaned close behind him, her hands moving to the ties of her dressing gown. She opened it. "Gods!" Kylar said, giving her a quick peck on the cheek without turning around far enough to see the rest of her. "I've got to piss like a war horse." He stood and started pulling on clothes. For a moment, Eline was frozen, her dressing gown hung open, her body exposed. "What are we shopping for?" Kylar asked, pulling his tunic over his head. She had barely laced up her dress when his head poked out of his tunic. "Well?" he asked. "What?" She felt like someone had just dumped cold water over her head. "Oh, Uli's birthday, right? We're getting her a doll or something?"
"Yes, that's it," she said.
What had she been thinking?